Good evening and welcome to Radio EduTalk. This is David Noble in Dalgetty Bay, and I am delighted to welcome to the show this evening Sue Ellis of the University of Strathclyde. And this evening we're going to be talking about poverty, literacy and the attainment gap. Good evening, Sue.
Good evening.
And just to start off with, could you give listeners a brief background to your career in education and academia?
Well, I started as a primary school teacher in Walthamstow, first of all in Crawley in West Sussex and then in Walthamstow in London. And when I got married, I moved to Scotland and got a job at Jordan Hill Teacher Training College, as it was then, which became part of the University of Strathclyde, its education faculty. And I've worked here ever since, really. I started off at Jordan Hill and I did a lot of primary science education, but I did a lot of CPD for teachers in the evenings and commissioned by local authorities in literacy research, and that was really that's really my passion, literacy research. I'm now Professor of Education at Strathclyde, and I'm co-director of the International Public Policy Institute Centre for Education and Social Policy at Strathclyde.
Thanks very much. And we're going to be talking with Dr. Ellis for the next 25 minutes or so, and if you've got any comments or questions, you can get in touch in two ways. You can email edutalker, that's edutalkr, at hotmail.co.uk, or you can pop something up on Twitter and include the hashtag edutalk. So I'm kind of unsure where to start, Sue. You've kindly sent in some links to papers that you've authored or co-authored in recent years, and I'll pop them up on the website as soon as I can and share them with listeners. But can you give listeners a flavour of some of the research and some of the work that you've done around tonight's topic of poverty, literacy and attainment gap?
Right. Well, the paper that I've put up that I co-authored was the one that we did for the Joseph Rowntree Foundation on closing the attainment gap in Scottish education. And that was particularly looking at what happens in Scotland, what's happening in Scotland at the moment in terms of closing the attainment gap, and the evidence in terms of what works and what doesn't work, what types of projects Scotland's tried before, what the evaluations of those projects have shown. So that was a particularly Scottish-focused one. The other ones I've put up are papers that I just think are really, really good and really interesting for teachers. There's a Beera Insights paper into the achievement gap, looking at whether parents or schools are responsible and what the research evidence actually shows about that. And really, it shows that that schools can do a lot and that parents already try to do a lot to help their children. It's just that if you're living in poverty, your options are quite limited. So, the strongest indicators of language and literacy level at age 7 are family income and the mother's education and reading habits. But when you actually look at the amount of support that parents give their children, there's no significant difference between parents in poverty and parents who are not in poverty. It's just that the ones who are living in poverty find it harder to actually provide the quality of support because their own education isn't as good often, but also because they don't have the sort of networks that more middle-class parents have. They don't have the resources to help them. They can't buy in the services that middle-class parents will often buy in. If your child's struggling and you can afford it, you buy tutors and things. And that often middle-class parents have got the sharpest elbows, so they actually make sure that their children access the freely available services that are there because they're articulate and they're able to fight for their child. Mm-hmm. So that's a sort of, it's a British Education Research Association, BERA, publication, but it's pulling together a lot of really interesting research about what matters in terms of how we relate to parents and where the policy push needs to be at school level and at local authority level. The other paper is a joint paper between SDCYP and Save the Children, and that's about young people's views on poverty and education in Scotland. And that was a paper where young people raised the issue about the actual costs of supposedly free schooling in Scotland, things like the cost of school equipment, uniforms, but also the cost of things like books and calculators, the what you need to do to study, to access learning support and study support, small costs that, that people who are not in poverty don't even notice, like the cost of buying things at school bake sales, red nose days, non-uniform days, the charging for school concerts or to selling children's work at a school fair, which if you're on the breadline really can push you over. If you've got two or three kids and you have to buy two or three lots of work or pay to see two or three lots of different class concerts, that's quite a lot. As well as bigger costs, like the costs of if you need a computer for your home, for your homework, and things like applications to UCAS. I mean, that costs as well. Just to apply to go to a university, you have to come up with a fee. That's ridiculous.
Absolutely. Oh my goodness.
I was quite horrified when I realised that, actually.
So you've kind of put the context in place there, Sue. So, I mean, maybe going to the paper that you co-authored for the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, what kind of approaches do work or are likely to work? I mean, I know there's several that you write about. Maybe pick out a couple that you feel maybe are increasingly on the agenda or should be on the agenda in Scotland.
Well, the things that we really need to look at are, first of all, the quality of leadership in schools. That's not actually in our paper, because our paper was really about well it is in our paper, but it's not a sort of real hard hitting bit. But the quality of political leadership and the quality of professional leadership is really important, because it needs to be really clearly prioritized and focused on, and visionary in terms of saying no excuses. So that's important. And the quality of teaching and learning is the second thing. And the third thing is linking the curriculum that children get to communities and to families in ways that really make a difference. So if you're thinking about actually wanting to make a difference, you have to think about the leadership, the links with communities and with families, and the quality of teaching and learning that goes on in a school. We know that we can make a really big difference to some of the poorest children in our society. There's no reason why being poor should stop you succeeding at school. We know from the research, you know, there's lots of research studies that look at how different schools are achieving, and we know there are outlier schools which outperform the norm. You look at the sort of catchment they've got and their pupil population, and you would expect their achievement to be quite low, and it's not. So we need to look at what it is those schools do that makes it really effective. We know there are some local authorities that do much better by their poorer children than others, and we need to look at what's happening there that makes it effective. And we also know at teacher level there are some teachers that make a difference and some teachers that don't. A year with a really, really good maths teacher will put 18 months onto a child's mathematical knowledge. And a year with a really bad maths teacher, that child only gains 6 months. So the actual quality of teaching and learning, including the quality of motivation, is really important.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, when you're saying there about professional leadership and leadership across schools, do you feel that we've got a broad enough notion of what that should look like in Scottish education? I mean, there's been a lot of development, whether it's the new Scottish College for Educational Leadership, various programmes that are coming on stream, new kind of routes to headship. Can you say whether you feel that we're on the right track, or whether it's too narrow a kind of focus on professionalism and not enough about the wider community, as you say?
Well, no, I went out and did a talk just recently to the Scottish College for Educational Leadership, and they were really interested in what it is that what the evidence is for what they can do to actually improve the life chances of some of the most disadvantaged pupils in Scotland's schools. And they're a really dynamic group of people. You know, if every head teacher's like that, then I think we're on to, you know, we really can look forward to Scotland doing absolutely great things. I think that there are that there are big issues in that the demographics of poverty in Scotland are quite different from the demographics in England or the United States. So in Scotland, our schooling is much more comprehensive in that every school is going to have children living in poverty in it. It's not just schools who are in areas of deprivation. If we direct all our resources and energies and focus only on the schools that are in areas of deprivation, we'll only be getting about 41% of the kids who are living in poverty. The rest of them are going to schools that are not in areas of deprivation. So the really big message that needs to go out to leaders is that poverty is something that they need to focus on in their own school, because there will be kids living in poverty in their school. The trouble is, it's with the in-work poverty that we have at the moment, where parents are working, but they're on low hours or low pay or 0 hours contracts or insecure work. The problem is, it's actually sometimes quite hard to recognise who those children are. Mm-hmm. So schools actually thinking quite hard about the children that they're teaching, and perhaps not being swayed by the stereotype of what poverty looks like. You know, when you ask people about poverty, it can often produce all sorts of stereotypes about what those communities are like. Mm. And actually, when you look at the reality, they're not like that at all.
So I just wonder, are you suggesting there, Sue, that, you know, there's a need for teachers to be really alert to where poverty might manifest itself within a school or within families? But you seem to be talking about children, families where not only will they not be formally recognised as living in poverty, but they may not desire the label at all of being in poverty. And surely the only way for us to recognise that and the impact on a young person's school experience is really on the ground level with support assistants, school staff and teaching staff.
That's right. I mean, we really, really need to be thinking outside the sort of stereotype of what poverty looks like, and actually recognising the kids that might find that might be really going home to home circumstances that are very, very difficult indeed, even though both parents are working. So focusing on the right kids is really, really important. The other thing I think that's really important for teachers is to focus on the research knowledge that we've got about what works. You know, the medics, when they talk about medical knowledge, they have a sort of diamond shape, and at the top of the diamond, they've got the proven things, the things that they know, if you do this, it will work. And then across the sort of wider part of the diamond, they've got the promising interventions, the things that will maybe work in certain circumstances, but you need to monitor them quite carefully. And at the bottom bit of the diamond, they've got the things that we know won't work. And I think it's really important that, because every school now is facing quite severe financial straits, it's really important we don't waste teacher effort, we don't waste children's time, and we don't waste money by going for things that are unproven, if in fact there are proven or promising interventions that we could actually be using.
So,
does that make sense?
Absolutely, Sue. So, you know, maybe focusing on literacy for a moment, then can you tell us a bit more from international studies, what works in terms of reading, improving reading ages, comprehension ages, etc. Within Scottish or primary or secondary schools.
Right. The what happens for literacy is the most important thing to recognise is that literacy isn't just an autonomous set of skills that you can just pick up and use. What you learn depends on what you think literacy is for. And what's quite clear, what the research shows, is that different communities actually have very different views about what literacy is for, why you might learn literacy. They might have different views about how it's appropriate to talk about literacy. And so when you're thinking about your language and literacy curriculum, you need to not just think about the sort of narrow bit of teaching children to decode text, but you actually need to do a huge amount of work on core language development, so giving a rich experiential curriculum so children develop their vocabulary, and also thinking about how you use literacy in the curriculum so that children actually realize how they can harness literacy and use it to get the ends that they want. The sorts of things that I'm thinking about are one of my second year students actually a few years ago was out on his teaching practice, and he got the kids to write letters of complaint, and they could write about anything that in the world that they wanted changed. And one child wrote to say that his local football team had stopped doing the parent and child cheap entry ticket to the football on the Saturdays. And the football team wrote back and said, "You're right, we just forgot about it when we redid our pricing.
Wow.
When you come next week, it'll be back." Now, for a child from a low literacy community, that really is illustrating the power of writing a good letter. Not just for that child, but for every child in the class. Do you see what I mean?
Mm, so absolutely.
We need a literacy curriculum that doesn't just teach the skills, but actually shows kids why it's worth becoming literate. And that a lot of the turnaround pedagogies that they're using at the moment highly successfully in places like Australia are actually doing that, particularly in low literacy communities. But I think for every child, it's really important that they actually learn that they can do that well. I was at a school in Stirlingshire a few years ago, and it was primary 1-2, and they were going to show me around the classroom. And I said, "Where are you going to show me first?" And they said, "We're going to show you our sink." And it was the classroom sink. And they'd written a letter writing campaign to actually get a sink installed in their hut, so they, when they did painting, they didn't have to go and get buckets of water from the main building.
My goodness.
And then they'd done another letter writing campaign to get the tiles for the back of the sink. They'd done a letter writing campaign to get the paint to paint the back wall. But all of that is actually illustrating to the children that it's really, really worth learning to read and write, because you can get the changes to your life that you want by reading and writing. So there's that sort of reading and writing. There's also the sort of reading and writing where you use reading and writing to organise your thoughts and to remind you to do things. And so building that sort of low-stakes reading and writing into the curriculum and allowing children time to use their writing, not always to get it marked by the teacher, but to actually organise their thoughts and order their thinking about something, is really important. So you need a rich language and literacy curriculum that shows kids the point of learning to read and write, whether they're 5 or whether they're 15, as well as the skills. In terms of the skill development, there are 3 things that are really important. One is decoding and being able to decode fairly fast and fluently, not always with phonics, but using a range of cues is important. The second is comprehension, and teaching comprehension really, really well. Not always with activities that test children's comprehension, but actually talking to them about how a reader might visualize a text, or how a reader, while they're reading it, or how a reader might listen to the intonation of, or put accents onto characters to help them track who's talking. So the actual comprehension strategies that somebody might use. And the evidence is that you don't need to perhaps do huge amounts of exercises on that, and you don't need, but you do need to just mention it often. A sort of drip, drip, drip effect is important. And the third thing is that matters for reading is reading engagement, the quantity of reading that kids do. And that requires them to think, that requires teachers to put the right books in front of the right children, but also allow spaces in the curriculum for children to network themselves around books, so that reading becomes part of the social fabric of the classroom that isn't inspired by the teacher. The kids are getting each other to read because they want to read, and they're developing their own identities as readers. Now, all of that is quite hard to put into a set of plain activities, but I think if we want to crack the literacy problem in Scottish schools, we really need to adopt that very broad approach. Mm-hmm. There's some quite interesting studies actually done that looked at that said that actually it's not programs of teaching that are important. What's important is the actual amount of time that children actually get to spend reading continuous text. And that sometimes when teachers were given very, very complicated programs of reading to get through, the kids actually didn't have any time to actually read texts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they actually didn't make as much progress as the teachers who had much less complicated programs, but actually allowed the children more time to just read.
Yeah.
And as they read, they got more fluent at reading. In any given reading period, they read 40% more than the kids who were less fluent, and so they actually learnt more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, there's lots of ways to crack a nut in terms of literacy. And the most successful teachers teach on the hoof all the time. You know, they pick things up, they follow through, they seize the teachable moments.
Teachable moments, yeah, oh, absolutely. That's what I was going to say. And yeah, so, I mean, there's a lot of great advice there, and it's, you know, evidence informed, evidence based. I'm wondering some of what you're talking about, particularly a few moments ago, there seemed to me as if a teacher would really need to be trained in certain approaches. So I'm wondering what you think about where we're at just now, Sue, in terms of new curriculum, so-called new curriculum, and the responsibility of all for every child's literacy development. Are we trained? Are we informed enough to really make a difference as a whole teaching profession in terms of our young people's literacy? Or do you think there's still very much a need for specialist teachers within both primary and secondary sectors, either driving forward everybody's professional development, or actually taking the responsibility for various approaches and programmes within schools?
Well, my personal view is that there isn't enough in initial teacher education courses on literacy or numeracy teaching or health and wellbeing teaching, actually. I think that over the years, the amount of time available for that has been eroded. Stuart Maxwell, the chair of the Education and Culture Committee at Holyrood, did a Freedom of Information request a year and a half ago, and found that actually there are two courses in Scotland which only in a four-year degree for primary teachers only give 20 hours to literacy teaching. And that's shocking. I wouldn't let someone cut my hair if they had only had 20 hours training, let alone teach my child to read. Mm-hmm. When you think how complicated the process can be and how much research there is that teachers need to know about in order to do it. So that's, I think that initial teacher education is an issue. I think continuing teacher education is an issue. I think that there is also, in secondary schools, there's a policy focus on basic literacy, but actually the research shows that secondary teachers make a difference when they teach what's called disciplinary literacy. So when a chemistry teacher actually teaches children how to read like a chemist, what sort of knowledge do you need to bring to the text, how is the text going to be structured, what sort of vocabulary, and has really good techniques for teaching discipline-specific vocabulary to children, that's really important. And then when children move to history, they need to bring a different set of expectations and mindsets to the text. You know, if you're reading a chemistry text, you're not expected to question whether or not the text is right. If you're reading history or modern studies, you are saying, who wrote this, why did they write it, and is there a different way of interpreting these events? So a very different sort of mindset, very, very different types of text structures, very discipline-specific vocabulary, and a different sort of knowledge base that you need to bring in terms of evaluating that text and responding to it. And so what the literacy research for secondary teachers is saying is that if we support secondary teachers in actually thinking about how their own discipline uses literacy to help kids be better at geography, at history, to think more like a chemist, to think more like a geographer, then actually we will actually be improving their literacy. And that's the problem that many children in poverty face, rather than issues with sort of generic literacy about punctuation or spelling and handwriting and those sorts of things. You know, there are a few children that have those sorts of difficulties, but the majority of children benefit from very, very discipline-specific literacy instruction and actually moving where literacy comes in the pedagogical cycle for secondary kids. Typically, literacy will often come at the end of the lessons. The teachers will do all the teaching, they'll teach all the big ideas, and then they'll get the kids to read something about it. And the problem with that is that the kids never read anything that actually tells them anything new. So moving the reading to the beginning of the lesson, where you're actually showing the kids how to read it, how to pull the ideas out of the text, and you're using the text to teach, and then you do all your enrichment activities and your activities that deepen the understanding, and then maybe get the kids to read it again at the end or to write about it at the end, you're actually repositioning where literacy comes in the pedagogical cycle, and you're actually showing kids how to read and write. And that's really important, because employers are telling us that they actually need employees who can read complex texts, the sort of text that their kids get in secondary school. So showing children how to read those texts rather than pre-teaching all the ideas and then letting them read the text on their own is really important. Nice. We did a research project just recently, actually, on disciplinary literacy, and we found very simple things like, well, it was teaching to the whole class, but reframing how you ask questions. So when you got to a complicated word, rather than saying, what does that word mean, which only one or two kids in the class can answer, and the rest of them don't really listen to the answer when it's given because they're irritated that they don't know, the teacher gives the definition. So you might say, find me the word that means worn away. Yes, it's erosion. Do you see what I mean? So that you actually give the definition and all the kids then have to look for that word.
Yeah.
So it involves the whole class more. Now, that's a very simple pedagogical shift, but it did seem to be make for a much more inclusive classroom environment. Mm-hmm. So there's lots that can be done in terms of literacy at every single stage.
Yeah. I'll just we're just coming into the last 5 minutes or so of tonight's show, Sue, and I'll just remind listeners that you're listening to Sue Ellis, who's Professor of Education at the University of Strathclyde, and we're just talking about poverty, illiteracy and the attainment gap. You can email or tweet any time in the last 5 minutes, and we'll put your comments or questions to Sue before the end of the programme. Now, just going back to your the paper that you co-wrote, Sue, you talk about the research and you draw conclusions around nurture groups, peer tutoring, one-to-one tutoring. But later on, you then talk about mentoring as something different from tutoring, of course, and say that possibly tutoring, and I appreciate it might be very difficult in the current climate and many authorities to fund or find the resources for, but the tutoring is clearly has a greater impact than mentoring.
Well, no, it doesn't. It has a different sort of impact.
Ah, right.
So if children are having difficulties with particular aspects of their schoolwork, then I think tutoring is the way to go. And either peer tutoring, which gives children consistent practice, if they're not getting a lot of reading practice at home or they're not getting a lot of help at home, then peer tutoring is helpful. One-to-one tutoring is also helpful. So teachers just taking the time to spend 15 minutes with a child who's having difficulty and doing it quite regularly with the aim of actually getting the kid so that they actually don't need that tutoring anymore. Making the child independent is important. Mentoring, the research on mentoring is that it's If the mentors are well chosen and well matched to the child, it can be hugely beneficial. And it can particularly, I mean, we run a mentoring project with kids who are really clever, who should be going to university to do veterinary science, medicine, law, but who have no relatives who've ever been to university before. And we provide mentors who take those children from S4 right the way through into their university career. Now, that works really, really well, but the mentors have to be well-trained, carefully matched. There has to be a quality relationship, and they have to meet regularly. A mentoring arrangement that isn't well set up and that breaks down can often fail children who've already been failed too many times in the past. So you have to be quite careful with that. We also do things at Strathclyde, like we do the Strathclyde Literacy Clinic, where our students do work in teams of four and take a child who perhaps is struggling with literacy and work together as a team to move that child on. And some of the children in the literacy clinic make fantastic progress just in the space of 10 weeks. I mean, some of them come on from reading ages of 5 to reading ages of 7 or 8, you know, in the space of 10 or 20 weeks, depending on how long they're in the clinic for. But the students do that, and they work together. So one will go on a Monday, one on a Tuesday, one on a Wednesday, one on a Thursday, and they all have to agree what the priorities are for that child. They all work to those priorities, and they ring each other up. So the Monday student rings the Tuesday student up to say how her session went and what she thinks needs to be done next. And so the students have to work as a team, but the students really get a lot out of it in terms of their expertise in terms of teaching literacy. They get much better orchestrating their own knowledge about what works and using resources and teaching in a responsive way. And the kids obviously benefit because they move on as well. So there are things that are important. One-to-one tutoring, sometimes it's only a question of really, really short little five-minute sessions with a child, just to taking an extra 5 minutes at the end of class to explain something or to remind a child of something. You know, it doesn't have to be big, big, big sessions. But it has to be driven by the teacher, who really is absolutely determined that every child in their class will succeed and isn't prepared to accept the fact that some kids don't seem interested or don't seem able to do it.
I mean, just finally for myself, Sue, you know, we're looking at the national picture. We had the announcement last month, in February, by the Scottish Government around the funding for the Scottish Attainment Challenge. So what are your thoughts on what might come out of the funding there, and will Strathclyde University be involved in any way?
Well, the money's been given to six local authorities, the six local authorities that had the highest percentage of children living in poverty. It's up to those local authorities to devise interventions that will work with those children. I think that the important thing is that the impact is measured properly, because one of the things that came out of the Joseph Rowntree Foundation report was that a lot of Scottish initiatives, we spend huge amounts of money and we haven't got a clue about whether or not they raised attainment. £15 million on Schools of Ambition, and the evaluation didn't show whether or not the kids actually improved one jot. And that's really not on. We have to measure and evaluate whether or not projects are having the impact they intend to have, because otherwise we won't learn from them.
Your kind of clear message then, we've given several this evening, Sue, but we mustn't be accepting failure. We have to kind of challenge practice every turn. You also seem to be suggesting as well then about the possible hidden poverty, but also that in every school in Scotland, because of the nature of our system, there will be many children affected, possibly quite profoundly. And so it's not only about looking at the practices of the schools that are bucking the trend, so to speak, but also being attuned, I suppose, school leaders being attuned within their own establishment to what might call kind of intra-school differences in progress.
Yeah, and you need good data for that. But every single teacher listening here will have at least one child in their class living in poverty. And it's a question of actually knowing who those kids are and actually making sure that we do the things. That child's had a hard enough start in life anyway. And it's making sure that we as teachers actually do the things that mean that we're not making their life harder, and that they are going to actually be able to use education to get out of poverty. Because these are kids who are, you know, the teachers, the lawyers, the doctors, the journalists, the politicians, the economists, the scientists, the engineers of the future. And that's really important.
Just before you go, Sue, then, in terms of your work within the university and maybe other projects that you haven't mentioned this evening, where could listeners go to find out more information? Because it seems that you're involved in so much, a prolific writer, but also there's so much going on within your particular establishment.
Well, the Strathclyde University website, the School of Education website, has got an entry on the left called Development Projects, and things like the Literacy Clinic are up there. There's a Malawi project up there. The Disciplinary Literacy, the Genre Pedagogy project is up there. So you can get information from there. And if anyone's got projects that are, you know, going to be interesting to us, we'd love to hear about them.
Well, thank you so much for taking time out this evening, Sue. I've really enjoyed speaking with you. And if there are any comments or questions from listeners in the days to come, I'll be sure to forward them on to you. So thanks again.
Thanks a lot.